The Memoirs of a POW Baby from World War II. This is Maren Hinderly speaking with...
Erling Jorsted.
Right.
And he is going to give us...
Coming of age during World War II.
Coming of age during World War II. We are assisted by Dan Kalman on the music, and we have Sonia, Janice, and Wes, all reading No Man Is an Island. And so, are we ready to go? Can you be heard?
Can I be heard? Bradley, can you hear me? No. Upstairs.
This mic isn't working. I'm going to give you my mic.
How's that now? Is that better? Did you turn down the music?
Okay, turn down the music.
I think he is.
Now.
How's that?
I'd like to introduce Laurel, who is going to be our stage manager and help us keep track of the time. We begin. School days. 1931-1939.
We're going to have to get rid of that.
My mom and dad went to college at St. Olaf. And my dad, as a freshman, told his roommates, you can date Mary Osgard, but don't get too fresh because I'm going to marry her. This had a negative effect on my mother. She thought, who is this arrogant fool? And he called her up that year and asked her out. And she was just curious enough to say, yes, I'm going to give this guy a hard time, she thought. He took her out to the library, where he sat on one side of the table and she sat on the other, and he interviewed her. He asked her what books she'd been reading, and she told him. He asked her what the girls back at the dorm were talking about, and she stared at him like, what? What business is it of yours, and what do you want to know? He said, well, you know, my friends and I back at the dorm, we talk about great ideas, philosophy, history, art. We talk about politics, economics. What do you talk about? Well, mother went home and she thought to herself, you know, that arrogant fool was right. We've got to start talking about some of these things. Well, she gave father the cold shoulder, and she gave him she was so persistent and consistent that by the time they were seniors, she ended up having to propose marriage to him. And he said yes. So they proceeded to finish off their education from 1935 until 1939. They were in graduate school. Father was in graduate school. Mother got her master's in English and French. And it was there that she met a fellow named John Donne, a very interesting writer from the 17th century, who gave her a poem, a prose poem, that she carried with her throughout World War II. And in fact, it's now on a map of the world in her house. Sonia is going to read us that poem.
No man is an island entire of itself, a part of the main. If a cloud be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a manner of thy friends were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I am involved with mankind. Therefore, send not to know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
Shortly after this, they got married, much to my grandmother's delight. And then they announced they were going to spend their first year in Norway at the University of Oslo, much to my grandmother's dismay. She was furious. How can you do this? Her first and only son, married to the bishop's daughter, and leaving the country. Don't you know it's duchy over there, she said. They don't even have indoor plumbing. This did not daunt them, and they left. And they studied, and they learned. They learned more than they bargained for. In 1939, the Nazis were gathering their forces. Amsterdam was taken. Anne Frank went into hiding. Denmark was taken. And then they flew in to Norway, somewhere around Christmas of 1939. Mother and father were cross-country skiing near Lillehammer, where they had the Olympics, the Winter Olympics recently. And they heard the planes coming in, and one of their friends said, "Watch out!" And down they went into the ditch. The Nazis had come, and they were expelled from Norway. In a group of Americans, fortunately America had not declared war yet, so they were sent out with a number of Americans through Sweden, and then by train through Nazi Germany to fascist Italy. When they were in Sweden, the leader of their team, who was British and spoke excellent, perfect German, said, "I think I'd better leave you here because I'm carrying gold bullion for the Norwegians and I'm not going to go any further. I'm afraid that I wouldn't make it. Would you take over, Carol?" Carol spoke a little German, so he was the one that led the group down through Nazi Germany and into fascist Italy. Now they waited 3 weeks for a steamer, and mother says that father convinced her that they'd better wait because this might be the last chance they had to enjoy Sicily and Naples. So they went down there and they saw some of that. And mother actually had a chance to learn some Italian because of her years of Latin. And then they went back to the United States, where they were interviewed in Chicago by the Chicago Times, was it the Times?
Tribune.
The Chicago Tribune. And they had a picture of them in the Chicago Tribune, looking just fine, but underneath the caption read, "American students return from Europe, warmongers." So, Erling. I think I'm going to give you the pass the torch here, and you can speak to your time. If you want us to go back, we will go back. We time travel with Erling.
No, we'll start it about now. I can do that.
Okay,
I can
whatever.
Take this over. So,
okay.
Anyway, I thought the best way to sort of describe what I want to talk about is calling it coming of age. In World War II. I was born in 1930, and the war broke out in Europe, of course, in 1939. And I should say that I came from a very small, isolated, almost provincial little town, eight Norwegian Lutheran churches within 10 miles, which is pretty isolated and provincial. I had two older brothers who were ready for college when the war came, and they both were enrolled at St. Olaf College. And my first real memory of World War II that is so vivid in my mind was that it was the Sunday night of the St. Olaf Christmas concert, and my one brother was in the choir, and we were over visiting in the room they lived together in Edinburgh Hall, and we were over visiting them before the concert started. It always started about 7 o'clock, I think, and all of a sudden, although we knew things were happening and things didn't look good at all on the international scene, we heard the head resident of St. Olaf College, some of you might even remember him, Ansgar Sovik. He was the head resident at the time, running up and down the halls, shouting the Japanese are bombing Pearl Harbor. And that was pretty exciting for an 11-year-old boy, to be sure. And I looked at my parents, and I didn't understand at that time that they knew exactly what that meant so far as their two sons were concerned, their two older sons were concerned, because that meant their two boys would go to war. And we went to the Christmas concert, I remember very well, it was snowing a little bit, and went over, and President Bo offered a prayer for peace just before the concert started. And within a short period of time, obviously, the United States was very much at war. And it was the 4 years of experience that I had that really, in a sense, I think hastened my maturity. Because I would have grown up in a nice, safe, loving environment where we all knew what was right and what was wrong, and had loving, caring parents and a fine church and all the rest. And suddenly I was introduced to the international scene in a time where usually people weren't really didn't really have that opportunity. And suddenly we started listening very carefully to the radio. Didn't have television, obviously, those days. And we were interested, of course, in Edward R. Murrow, and we were especially interested in another person who happened to have been a Norwegian Lutheran by the name of Erik Severide. And we knew the Severide family very well because grandfather Thomas Severide was buried, and it's an interesting parallel here, he was buried in a cemetery at a place called Holden Lutheran Church, which is about 20 miles from Kenyon, and is the foundation really for St. Olaf College. And my great-grandparents were in the founding committee for that particular congregation. So we had a very deep interest in listening to Edward R. Murrow and somebody named Walter Cronkite, Charles Collingwood, and especially young Edward, and especially Erik Severide, listening to them broadcast from England, where they would broadcast from what the English, of course, called the tubes, or the subways, where people would have to go at night to be safe from the air raids, and so on. And then within a short time, within 1942, my brothers, you know, entered the service, as we used to call it, the military service, as did a lot of my relatives, and we started, mobilizing for war. I remember vividly, we saved our pennies and our nickels at that time, and when we had enough money, we would bring the money to school and we would buy war stamps, as they were called. They were pictures of soldiers, and when we had enough, we could cash them in, and we were buying war bonds, and eventually the final cost of one war bond would be $18.75. And if we held on to it for 10 years, if this rings a bell with anybody, if we held on to it for 10 years, it would come to maturity for $25. And that was big money in Kenyon in those days. That was big money for a youngster. It wasn't just sort of folding money to go on a weekend toot or something else like that. So remember it very, very well. And then, of course, came things like rationing. And the most important thing, of course, was gasoline and rubber tires also. And everybody started taking very, very good care of their cars. We had a 1941 Fleetwood Chevrolet, four-door maroon. And I remember that was pretty sporty in those days. And by the time the war was over, the tires were very shiny, but we were still able to get to church and do a few other things on this. Within a short time, sort of the bad news and the good news started coming in. And the bad news soon struck home to me in a way which I'll always remember. I had my two brothers who were in the military. One brother was in the Coast Guard, and my other brother was in the Marine Corps. Then I had two cousins. One was in the Army Air Force, and another was in the Tank Corps. One was Lyle Tigan. Harlan Tigan was his name. Lyle was his brother. I soon learned in 1943 that he was a pilot for a B-25 strafing over the beaches of Anzio and was shot down, and never found again. And my other cousin in the war was Ralph Haugen, who was in the Tank Corps with General Patton. And he had written home a few days before he went with Patton, and then finally was killed in war. He said if General Patton had said, "Today we're going to storm hell," he would say, "Right on, let's go for it." Patton had an enormous influence, really, on the troops, on the morale of the troops. Quite inspiring in those days. Today, war heroes aren't quite so popular, but they certainly were at that time. So I had two cousins who didn't make it, two cousins who didn't come home. And the war also, just two more stories here, the war also sort of came to the church. I belonged to First Evangelical.
Hold on, Erling. Oh. You're going to get to tell again.
Oh, okay.
let's hold it.
I do get carried away.
Yeah. Well, no, that's wonderful. It's just that we're going to go through this together.
That's right.
All right. Now, so we're in the war, right, in 1943, right, And so I'm going to get you, oh, where's my notebook? Did anybody see it? Well, that's what happened when we got picked up by the Japanese in the Philippines. And I'm looking for my thing, because I wanted to read you a little something that Mother wrote, my notebook. This is from her diary. When they were on their way to China, and they stopped in Japan. Japan was fighting the Chinese at the time, and they had dinner in Kobe. And I think it's kind of fun. This is 1940. And here they are. Actually, turn back one page, Laurel. Thank you. We're on No Man is an Island again. And in 1940, Mother's writing from Kobe. This is on a Monday. Yesterday, it was only Kobe. There was too much rain to attempt any trips, so we really enjoyed the town. We walked, which is the only real way to see a town. We walked down the famous Motosadi Street with its myriad small shops. She was stopped here, and she continues the following day. It's early morning on Tuesday, and I am up on deck to enjoy the quietness and the gray morning sea. Only early like this do I feel as if I own the ship. The little street that we walked down was 3 miles long and had the strangest lampposts, which served as a sort of postcard frame to each scene. They had little lanterns on each side, and they went out over the street. She has a drawing. Our small globe, very ordinary, was the only one lighted when dusk came, however. It was much more fascinating to see the town on foot. The people were also much more normal, and I've never seen so many umbrellas and parasols with the bright colors of the women's kimonos flashing everywhere in the rain. This one street has no allowance for cars, so we all walk in the middle of the street and really get close to the people. We had the famous Japanese dish, sukiyaki, in a real Japanese restaurant. We were the only ones there. We had to take off our shoes because, of course, the floor was grass. And we sat on big black pillows around small tables with huge holes in the middle. First came the steaming, prepared perfumed towels with which we wiped our hands. Then came big kettles of charcoal. No, first tea, then the charcoal. Kettles were set in their holes. The food was prepared in a pan that fitted on top of this. Suet first, then thinly sliced beef, onions and onion greens, mushrooms, a kind of dumpling, some sprinkling sparkly crystals, and some long white threads. Hot water and spices. Then it was cooking. Each of us had a small blue dish into which they cracked an egg. When the food was ready, we beat an egg with our chopsticks, and they put meat and vegetables into it. The inevitable rice appeared and more tea, and we set about to feeding ourselves with chopsticks. I did not like it. Carol did. And ate a great deal. We had persimmons and apples for dessert. I'm glad to know the Chinese food is much better than that. And with that, I will invite Janice from China to read us No Man is an Island.
No man is an island entire of itself, a part of the main. If a cloud be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a manner of thy friends were. Any man's death diminishes me, because I'm involved with mankind. Therefore, Say not you know for whom the bell tolls. It tolls for thee.
And surely, surely this was true. As they proceeded to Hong Kong and to their assignment as missionaries in China, they were not allowed to enter. The war was too ferocious. So they were sent on down through the China Sea to Manila. At this point, I must admit that I think my parents were pretty stubborn Scandinavian Lutherans, Middle Westerners at that, because they would not turn back. They went to the Philippines and they started learning Chinese. They had trouble finding a good teacher when they got to Manila because they found out that they had to get the right tone and they needed someone with more tones than their first teacher and more tones than their second teacher. And finally, they found a teacher who could speak 8-tone Chinese and she stayed with them. This proved to be dangerous. They had no idea how dangerous. But this was why, later, my father and my godfather and my friend Billy's dad were taken in by the Japanese equivalent of the Gestapo for questioning. This happened after the war began with America fighting the Japanese. And Erling has already told you how his family got involved in the war and where he was when Pearl Harbor was bombed. But I haven't told you where I was. I was 7 days old. I'd been born December 1st, 1941. We can turn the page now, Laura. And my parents were frantic. They wanted to protect me, of course, as good parents. Any parent I chose would want to protect me. So they hurried to the only bomb shelter in town, which happened to be the basement of a private school. And when they got down there, they found it was so crowded, so dirty, so noisy, that they decided I was better off in the missionary cottage in Baguio, where they were living, outside of the outskirts of town. So we went back out there. And Judy Hyland, who was also a godmother of mine, was living in another little cottage, and she wrote a book, which you might want to check out of a library if you can find it. It was published a few years ago by Augsburg, and it's called In the Shadow of the Rising Sun. It's an excellent story of our experiences there. Her account of that first Christmas under bombardment in 1941 went like this. They decided they wanted to celebrate, so they got a tree, but they thought maybe they shouldn't because, after all, maybe they'd need everything they had if the Japanese came and they didn't have any food or provisions. They should save everything they could, so maybe they shouldn't be too lavish. So they were debating about this, and when they got back to their house, they found that the cook had made them this wonderful dinner. So they sat down and ate it, and while they were eating it, the minister, the Filipino minister, whom they'd been giving Bible studies with, came to them and said, "Can you come to the Christmas celebration of the Filipino people in the old town?" And they said surely they would. So they picked up their Bibles. Now you have to remember that the planes are still flying overhead and dropping bombs on Baguio, because this is the Battle of Baguio. But they went out in the middle of all of this, and they went to the town, the little village where these people were living, and they weren't there. The place was deserted. So they looked around and they decided they would leave. And they were on their way out when a little boy came out and beckoned to them and told them to follow him. They followed him to the caves where all the people had gone to keep themselves safe. And there they celebrated Christmas Eve. They sang carols, they read the word, and they had more food with each other, and I think they had communion too. And then they returned. 3 days later, the Japanese invaded. They came to pick Mommy and me up. I'd been spending the 3 weeks under our kitchen table in Mommy's arms. And they picked me and Daddy and Mommy and took us to our first prison, our first home as guests of the Japanese government, Camp John Hay. And before we left, the sergeant who picked us up told my dad, make sure you bring as many clothes as you can with you for your little girl. I'm really sorry that this is happening. I have 9 children myself. So father brought all three, and mother brought all three of my layettes. I had 3. I don't know why. I guess people thought I needed more clothes in the tropics or something. I don't know. But anyway, these baby clothes kept all the babies clothed for the first year, and the newborns especially. After the first 6 months, there were no babies who were born and lived. And so that was the close of the first year, the first Christmas in captivity, and 1942 began. Would you like to carry on here? Carry on, nurse. Thank you very much. I can't get this off. What did I do wrong? Well, there it is. It's the other way.
I'll just hold it.
Okay.
I was talking about how the war came to our little town. 2 things I remember very well was that we sang a song every Sunday in church. It was printed out and then put inside the hymn book, in the old black hymn book we had, and it was God Bless Our Lads. In air, on land, and sea. And I remember vividly the women in the choir would cry during the song because their boys were overseas during the war, and it made a lasting impression on me that happened. And the other one was a little bit more humorous, was that we had to prepare for air raids. And I really wasn't too worried that the Nazis were going to come and bomb Kenyon, Minnesota. That didn't strike me like a very real possibility, but my father was the air raid warden for our block. And it was a pretty big block, but anyway, and I was a Boy Scout, and we were all given cards that we were now members of the United States government because we were air raid messengers. And we had the blackout, and we had the wardens had the flashlights, and we were standing on the corner there of the street, 2nd Street and whatever it was, Main. And all of a sudden, I saw the blinking of the flashlight, and I figured, oh boy, the Nazis are coming. And I ran up there, and my father gave me a message to bring to the air raid warden in the next block, Art Werdahl. I can't remember even what the message was, but I was pretty impressed. I was doing official American government business, and I was beating those Nazis. I was helping winning the war. stayed with me, as well as bringing my quarters to school for the war stamps. Remember that very, very well. Then came the rationing, and I never did understand why they rationed ketchup. Because I was at the stage, and many of you can relate to this, where I would once in a while have food with my ketchup, and that suddenly this was gone. And we learned how to have the different color green stamps and red stamps and yellow stamps, and we learned that there were some chiselers. And we learned that there were those who bought sugar, for instance. They said they bought the sugar before the hoarders got it. And that sort of remained a standard joke that lasted over the period of time. But basically it worked. The one folly I remember was that they decided we should have a roundup of all scrap rubber and turn it in, and they would bring it up to a big place up near Fort Snelling, which is near, of course, Minneapolis, just south of Minneapolis. And we thought this was a patriotic thing to do, so we got out our old galoshes and all the rest of the things, old hot water bottles and everything, and put them on the trucks and said, now take that, you Axis powers. We're going to, we're going to help win the war with this. The only trouble was that they kept bringing rubber there for all years of the war, and by 1945, when the war ended, you can imagine what the smell was for the rubber pile near Fort Snelling. It hadn't been used. But I can't even remember how they got, whatever happened to it. I remember another one, too. We were supposed to save newspaper and cardboard. We're doing now with recycling. And the Boy Scouts were again given the chance to do something about this. And I was kind of puzzled because I thought we were going to take this cardboard up to some war plant where they were going to make it into something that they needed for the war. But what we did was take it to the next town called Faribault, Minnesota, where it was turned over to an insulation company. And what they were doing was getting, free cardboard for their company, and we didn't understand quite well, quite as well as we should have, what this had to do with the war effort. And as it turned out, it didn't have anything to do with the war effort. The insulation company was getting a nice deal from this. So there were humorous moments that, but in the long run, the war did go on. So that'll not be enough for now.
Well, now that we're stopping for a second, I'm going to ask Wes. Wes, where were you at this point in time? Stand up next to the mic here so you can be heard.
I was on a farm as a teenager in South Dakota, and then toward the end of the war, I went to Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. And I remember the rationing and the tires and all the other things associated with the war. I remember Franklin D. Roosevelt, mm-hmm. who said, there is no fear but fear itself. He said, I hate war. My wife Eleanor hates war. And the reporters added, and my dog Bala hates war. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then life went on.
That's
we struggled
great.
Away on the farm and went off to college. And
we'll get back to you then.
Pardon?
We'll get back to you after we've gone through a little more of this. Well, meanwhile, Marin was just a year old. And father and mother and all of these people, 500 of us in Camp John Hay, an Army Officers Club, an American Army Officers Club, which the Japanese couldn't use for their officers because the Americans had bombed the plumbing. And the consequence of this was that throughout these 3.5 years, we struggled with severe dysentery along with malnutrition. And we had anemic dysentery. And mother's story is sad but true. My mom is very fastidious, not like me at all. And she would always be on the clean side of the dish team. And she found out that she had double dysentery. She didn't have any soap to wash her hands. And the doctor said, just keep your hands under the faucet for 3 minutes. So, I mean, there was no faucet. There was a pump. So how did she do that? Well, she did it somehow. And then she was wondering if she should tell some of her colleagues and people, the women that she was living with, about this, because after all, it could be dangerous. And she was thinking about it when Jessie Smith came in with this bright light in her eyes, Mother says. And she says, oh, guess what I just heard? The commandant has said that he is fed up with all this dysentery, and anybody with double dysentery is going to be shot. Mother decided she wasn't going to say anything about it. But we continued to survive under very difficult conditions, largely because Father and some of the other missionaries got mad. 3 weeks into our captivity. It was chaos. People were, the rich people were getting food through the barbed wire fences, and the rest of us were starving. My mom's milk had stopped. All the young mothers' milk had stopped. Babies were crying all the time. Everybody was just going crazy. So Father went to the commandant and said, "Look here, the adult men are losing 5 pounds a day. The babies aren't getting anything to eat. We have to organize here." And he said, "We're going to have elections with your permission." And the commandant said, could see the wisdom of this, so he agreed. And they had elections. They became self-governing. They divided everybody up into teams, and they rotated just like they rotated jobs so that nobody stayed in the kitchen except for head of the food operations, Martha. And this person was from the Soviet Union. He was Russian, and he had been cooking in a fancy French restaurant, but he knew how to handle food, and so he made sure it was handled right. The other people that didn't rotate were the professional medical people. And they stayed in touch with everybody and gave the kitchen directions too. So that to increase the calcium in our diet, we were instructed to crush the eggshells and eat them. But before we did that, we were to peel off the albumin, that little thin skin on the inside, and that we gave to the hospital, or it wasn't a real hospital, but it's where people went, sick bay, for them to have, because that had some extra special vitamins in it. And they filed iron and sprinkled it in the food to give us more iron. My mother, with her dysentery problem, after our second celebration in prison camp when we had meat for the first time, I hope this doesn't happen to us here after our hamburger dinner tonight, she got so sick, she had to go to the hospital for 6 weeks, and she was put on the dysentery diet, which was strained water that boiled the rice. So she got some starch, mashed bananas, and something else. I can't remember what it was. Anyway, they were very, very resourceful. In fact, my dad said, these guys, two of them trained at Harvard Med School, could perform surgeries with safety pins. It was hardly that elaborate. I mean, my dad was a storyteller. But they were very resourceful. And one of the doctors, who was a Mennonite, had complained about having the miners come to services, Christmas services, because somehow or other the miners always got drunk at Christmas. Didn't matter how hungry we were, they could always find booze for Christmas. They get drunk and sing the Christmas carols drunk. Well, this offended certain religious people in the camp, and they thought that they shouldn't go to Christmas services with us. But Father said, look, it's for everybody. Nobody here is any better than the drunkest engineer. And consequently, we all did celebrate together. And at the end of the war, the same doctor gave my dad was having an ulcer hemorrhage, and he gave him a transfusion. So he saved his life. So there was a way in which everybody did not get along and quarreled, but also survived together. This was very different from a lot of other prison camps. At the end of 42, we had our first chance to get together. This commandant, our first commandant, we had three, wouldn't allow the men and women to live together. So at the end of the year, he said, well, we could have a party. And my mom decided to have a birthday party for me. She didn't have anything to make the cake with. Now, what do you make cake with? Martha?
Flour.
Flour, no flour. What else? No eggs. No sugar. But she was going to have a birthday cake. And that was when her friends, my second mothers, said, Mary, don't you worry about it. We know what we can do. We'll get the rice scrapings from the pans. This was the great treat, rice scrapings. Everybody who did KP got the rice scrapings. You know how it sticks at the bottom? Well, that was the special treat. So instead of eating it, they brought it to my mom. And for a week before, everyone brought their rice scrapings until she had a nice little mound that she could mold into the shape of a cake. Meanwhile, my mom had been very busy. I was growing out of all my clothes, those layettes. I mean, they'd long gone. And I needed a party dress. Well, she didn't have anything until she looked at the few things she had left that she'd brought in, and she found her silk pink negligee that her college roommates had given her when she got married. So she figured, can't use this. She cut it up and made a dress for me out of it. Now I was in my little pink dress, and we had a cake of sorts. Oh, she had also a candle that she had saved to put in the middle. But frosting, we have to have frosting. Ah, Mary, don't forget, we have the peanut butter. This was a treasure. Everybody at Holding will appreciate the peanut butter. This was a treasure because the Filipino women, whom Judy and my mom and some of the other women had become friendly with, would shove peanuts for them through the barbed wire fences. And they'd pick them up, crack them open, and pound them down into butter. It was a very special treat kept high up on a shelf. I knew right where it was when I got a little bit older. And they took it down and they spread the cake. Well, the chef, our Russian chef, offered to carry it in because he knew how. So he did. And everybody sang. Would you all please join me just to give us a little of the sense of what it was like? Happy birthday.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you.
Wait. About at this point, he got so excited, he dropped the cake. But remember, it wasn't a regular cake. It was so heavy, it landed right side up. So all he had to do was just pick it up and bring it over. And now, Marin, let's say Laurel's me now. Now, Marin, my godparents always ask me this when they tell me this story. Do you know what you did next? And even though I've heard the story 100,000 times, I always have to say, know what? And they said, well, Marin, we gave you that cake, and you went like this. Right in the middle of it. Pink dress and all. And they laugh and laugh and laugh. So happy to see somebody squandering their precious resources. Well, that was the end of 1942.
Than if we hadn't had it, that's for sure. We had to find out where all these places were, and we learned that in a hurry. Two stories, and then I'll end with those, is that one, how strange the impact of the war was on people's lives. My brother, when he entered St. Olaf, was going to be a public school music teacher. He was very good in voice, and he had in the choir, and he had a band and different things. And he entered the Marine Corps, and they were finding out what the specialties were for everybody, and they found out that he had this background in music, and they also found out that he had studied Latin in high school. And I've told the Latin teachers this at St. Olaf, and this is a good reason for studying Latin. you get to be a chaplain's assistant because he could handle the mass. The mass at that time was still said, of course, in Latin. So he became, in the 5th Marine Division on Camp Pendleton, he became a chaplain's assistant for both the Protestant and the Catholic people. And there he met another chaplain's assistant, namely, her name was Frieda Heiss from Shamrock, Texas. And they fell in love and had a great romance even at Camp Pendleton. And then came the time for combat, and the 5th Marine Division was the division that invaded Iwo Jima. And Curtis went in on about the third round of this. He was a medic. He didn't have any weapons, but he was a medic, you know, for the medical corps. And it was a life-transforming experience for him because you can imagine boys, you know, dying right in his arms, you know, with all the terrible wounds and all the rest of these things. He was trying to do what he could with plasma and with sulfa and the other things, but at that point it was as though God spoke to him, and he wasn't saying that, you know, save me and I'll become a minister, sort of like Luther did, you remember, when the famous lightning struck him along the way. But Curtis decided at that point to be a minister and came back with Frieda and went to the seminary and then became a minister in the Southwest part of the country the rest of his life. It's one of those strange things. Otherwise, he probably would have been, you know, the high school music director in Elbow Lake or Hackensack or, you know, some place like this. You never know. Strange, strange things. The other story was at the end of the war, and then this will be my last story. We knew things were looking good. The war had already ended in Europe, of course, on VE Day in May of 1945, and we were pretty sure things were going to wind up in Japan. In Japan, we never know exactly all the things, but we were listening to the radio. I remember vividly it was August 14th, 1945, and we were still taking care of our old maroon Chevy, and we were washing it, and then we had the radio on, and we heard Big Ben toll midnight coming out of London, and it was Prime Minister Attlee at that time who made the announcement that the war was over. And this news arrived in Kenyon at 6 p.m. on August 14th, and the WCCO, some of you remember, sort of blurted in with the news that gas rationing now was instantly, you know, immediately over. So we proceeded instantly up to Bryan Standard Gas Station and filled up the tank. This sounds like Lake Wobegon. If you're right, this is, you know, Garrison Keillor, I think, grew up in my hometown. I really do. It's straight out of there. And we filled up our gas tank and we went to Owatonna for the Steele County Fair as our celebration, because my two brothers were going to come home alive.
I think this is a good time to hear Wes read No Man is an Island.
No man is an island entire of itself, a part of the main. If a clod be washed away by the sea, Europe is the less, as well as if a manner of thy friends were. Any man's death diminishes me because I am involved with mankind. Therefore, send not to know for whom the bell tolls, it tolls for thee.
There were many who didn't return. And there are many today, too, that are suffering this way. But there was still a sense of wonder and joy when mother and father came back from, and I happened to be with them, came back from the war. We landed in San Francisco. We went through the Golden Gate. And Uncle Bob met us on the dock. Now, Uncle Bob was my mom's uncle, and he had fought in World War I with the Englishman who opened up King Tut's tomb. So Father's favorite description of him was that he was one of the three who didn't die by the curse of King Tut, who had said that, you know, anyone messing with my tomb will die a violent death. Uncle Bob, in fact, actually married a woman from the Ziegfeld Follies. And He was dressed in a white suit with a white hat. He looked great. So did everybody else. Mother and father and all the missionaries had saved an outfit for Liberation Day, and they were wearing it. But Mother said when she looked at the people on the dock, she thought she was looking at movie stars. They came down the gangplank, and Uncle Bob shook hands with Mother and Father and then gave them each, in his hand, $100 bill. He said, go out and buy yourself some new clothes. So they did. And then he took me by the hand and he said, we're going to go find something too, Maren. And I remember this. We walked up a hill and we came to a toy store. There was a window filled with dolls. Now, I knew what dolls were because my daddy had made me a clothespin doll for Christmas. So I knew what a doll was. But when Uncle Bob said, well, what doll do you want? I saw dolls with eyes that opened and shut. I saw beautiful lady dolls and darling little baby dolls. I saw dolls of every color and description. And I said, I want that one and 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 that one. So he took me in the store and he bought me every single one. Well, I also found out that I was in America because, I think this will be my last story since we're coming to the end here. I have a handout. You can have this. I'll Xerox it if you want it. It's a story about my mom's return. It's called We Have Everything. And she wrote it for Christmas magazine in the 40s. So it's an interesting story. But I'll tell you this story. When we were in Bilibid prison in 1945, we had a half a pig, and it wasn't the good half, and a bunch of cornmeal mush with a lot of boll weevils in it. And the people would say to me, oh, you poor thing, you have to eat this awful mush. And I'd look at them and I'd wonder what they were talking about. I thought it was delicious. I hadn't had anything else, and I was hungry. The other thing they'd say is, wait till the Americans come. You're going to get real milk. Real milk, I wondered. Wondered what that was. Well, when the Americans came, they actually did not have real milk. They had powdered milk. And they served it to us in cups. We stood in a circle, all as kids, and we had to hold the cups like this, and they poured the milk in. They poured it full. And I said, how far can I drink? They said, well, you can drink the whole thing, little girl. So I drank half of it. And they said, what's the matter? Don't you like this milk? And here's the point, I guess, that as a child growing up in prison camp, I was not scared of the bombs. I was not scared of the soldiers and their guns. I wasn't even scared of the starvation. The one thing that really scared me was losing my mommy and daddy. And they had said over and over again, Carol's really sick. He's got this ulcer. If only we could get some milk for him. So when they asked me, I said, I'm saving it for my daddy. Well, when I got to America, I did get real milk. I got it with Cheerios. And I took a nice big spoonful. It tasted terrible. And Janice, I think, can confirm that if you haven't been drinking milk, milk smells bad and it tastes worse. So that was the beginning of the Americanization of Marin in the liberated United States. One other thing, Father, in 1991, this was the anniversary of our captivity, the beginning of the war, looked at me and he said, shook his head and he said, Marin, he said, you know, you came back a lot quieter, a lot more serious, and a lot older than the other kids your age. And we really didn't want that to happen to you. But he said, you recovered. Thank you. Is it coming? As we leave this evening, we're going to invite Anna and all of you to enjoy a waltz compliments of Glenn Miller.